Since going back into the late 90s, so nearing a quarter of a century.
Yeah, well, that's because every day we learn new things, and that's why it feels like yesterday. So today on the show, we are going to be talking about encryption and how it relates to cybersecurity insurance applications and the conundrum and how that correlates with a lot of challenges that IT service providers are having with regards to helping their customers, and then also what encryption can actually do for you. So I will just kind of start at this high level thing here, and then Greg, you jump in where you want here. I might direct some interesting questions your way, but basically, what the cybersecurity insurance landscape has changed to in the last few years here is they are requiring disk encryption, you know, full disk encryption on everything. Of course, they're looking for encryption of backups, and then those backups, when they're transmitted over the wire to be done, transmitted in encapsulated secure tunnels. And one of the interesting questions I think we saw was we saw some insurance application questions that were, they kind of set off the baloney button is the best way I would describe it, because I feel like the question, I think this was your response to it, was that the question was very poorly worded. It was clear that that question was written by someone that didn't understand the difference between file hashes versus encryption, and, you know, hash algorithms versus encryption algorithms, and when what is in use and all of that. So that's some of the stuff that we want to talk about here. But on this whole disk encryption thing, I think it's still a bit of a hot button, and it's been historically difficult to do. Now with tools like Adaptive Defense 360, where you just buy the encryption module, which is, I don't know, I'm just off the top of my head, I think it's like another $27 a year. It's a whole big whoopo nothing sandwich to add it. And so it's just literally a turn it on button. The one deficiency of that, I think, is it doesn't do pre-boot authentication. So if you've got these really high security applications, you might still want pre-boot authentication. And then I still have giant furry question marks around, is that what you really want to do with your servers? So it's easier to meet those compliance requirements now, but it's not such an easy button that I think it's the type of thing that end users should be self-servicing, or that a lot of internal IT should be strategizing on those plans on their own. So one thing I learned this week that I thought was rather interesting was someone posted that they had the opinion that, and this was based upon a penetration test that they had, where they basically set up a computer and they gave a penetration tester a physical access to the machine with a local logon account that was just a user account, not an admin account. And with BitLocker on, they were unable to privilege escalate to admin level, versus with BitLocker off, they were able to privilege escalate to admin. And it had something to do with the protections of BitLocker preventing that local privilege escalation attack against the locally cached credential files associated with the admin profile. So I thought that was interesting, because if that's actually, you know, the case, that that's true, then that's just more bolstering of evidence as to why you should be doing disk encryption on everything. But circling back to this whole topic of the cybersecurity and insurance questions, and then I'll have you talk about hashes versus, like, file hashes versus encryption and some algorithms, is that I think the customers, you call them applicants, you call them the insured parties, they have no idea what in the heck most of these questions mean. And then the insurance companies are not having people like us put together those questions on the applications. I frankly don't know who they're using, but given the fact that all the applications are pretty much as equally not as accurate as they should be, then, you know, it's probably the same group of people writing the questions for the insurance companies, but it leaves the whole problem of a lot of IT people are looking at this stuff and saying, you know, what it says, yes or no. Should I just say yes or no? And the reality is you can't say yes or no. You have to actually take a process and take that question that they've asked and say, well, actually, with regards to that question, these are the actual technical details, and this is our posture, and this is what we're actually doing about it. So therefore, we don't feel that this is a yes or no question. We are saying we're not going to check the box yes or no. We're going to say C-section, you know, 42 in the attached document, and then expect that the actuarial people or the people who are assessing these applications need to be actually looking at that content and using brain power. But so tell us, I'm sure you remember that whole thing about the file hashes versus encryption, you know, MD5, SHA-1, SHA-256, AES, GCM, and all of those things. And like, you know, elucidate us as to difference between file hashes and encryptions and, you know, when you're using what.
Well, the incident or the question that really brought up kind of the topic for this podcast, it goes back many years where the insurance companies were really just kind of starting to look into providing a type of cyber insurance or protecting those assets. And the question, if I can remember the wording to it, was along the lines of, are your backups protected by means of encryption such as SHA-1? And it listed a number of what were hashable in encryptions, which really isn't a file.
I think it had
encryption.
MD5 in there too. Yeah, and you're right. That's not file encryption.
Right. So, you know, all that is doing essentially is assuring or giving you a method to verify that the file or the backup that you are looking at is the same as the backup that was created at the time that that hash was written. And that goes a lot to Felicia mentioning that, you know, a lot of these questions are worded in a way that are yes or no. And you have to look at these on the insurance applications like they're a trick question. You know, you're floating down a river in a canoe with 5 pancakes and the wheels fall off. How long does it take you to get to Chicago? You know, you can't give a yes or no answer to something like that. You really have to understand the question that's being asked, and at least the insurance brokers have gotten better with this, but at one time they really didn't even know what they were asking. They saw it someplace, they were at a conference somewhere, it was part of a webinar where somebody said that these are things you should be looking at. Your backup needs to be encrypted. So somebody, you know, did a Google search, whenever that became a verb. But somebody did a Google search and came up with here's types of encryption and didn't understand the difference between a reversible algorithm encryption versus a hash encryption. That again, it's just merely verifying that file. So,
the areas that I just want to bring home a point here, the areas where this type of stuff is still applicable is in supply chain risk management. You know, you need to go update your application server. Well, the manufacturer should be of that, the software, right, should be posting like an MD5 hash or a SHA-1 hash and says, hey, you download this file, and before you go and install it, you ought to be checking the hash on that and finding out, is the file you downloaded the actual file we intended for you to download? And so that type of stuff still has a great deal of applicability for supply chain risk management. But isn't there also a component associated with like phase 1 and phase 2 in terms of VPNs, where like phase 1 is the key exchange and it is actually using hashing to verify that file, that key exchange has not been tampered with in the process, whereas then on phase 2 we actually have the real encryption of the tunnel that is then negotiated between the two endpoints. So, you know, elucidate us on that one as well.
Well, you know, the easy answer is yes. But as we just discussed, you don't give yes or no answers to these.
Yeah.
So I've found over the years that while that's a good general understanding of the process, is you have endpoint A and endpoint B, they contact each other, you know, part of the handshakes, part of establishing that connection is going to be the phase one. And, you know, basically using preset algorithms, determinations to establish how they are going to exchange keys and then define the phase two. But what I have found is that not all device manufacturers necessarily group the same components in their phase one as somebody else's phase one. So in configuring and in designing those, building out the configurations, sometimes there's a little bit of gray area between what, say, FortiGate decides is phase one and what WatchGuard believes is phase one. So, you know, sometimes you need to pay attention to those. As in general, yes, that would be the understanding, but different manufacturers sometimes look at those steps differently.
Well, I think there's also device capability differences. You know, if I remember back to like January of 2016, I think that was the cutoff date for SHA-1 to be used as a phase two component. And it was like deprecated for encryption, but it wasn't deprecated for hashing. I may not be remembering that completely accurately, but at that time, there was a big push in 2016 to replace network layer security appliances that didn't support SHA-2 and the SHA-2, you know, components. It was literally a capability inside of the chipset, inside of the device. And because the federal government had basically said, you need to stop using SHA-1 for those purposes, then we needed to roll out devices that could keep up with the times. And I've also seen that also where we have, was it GCM 256 came out, what, a few years ago or something like that. You know, the federal government said, hey, we're switching to GCM 256, you know, and you look at it and go, well, gee, why were they saying that? And it was like computationally more efficient without compromising security. So I think another fascinating part of this is, You have to do your own, you know, does your device support it? You know, as you said, your manufacturers, depending upon what the things are that you're trying to get to communicate with each other, there's all that compatibility that has to be considered. But it's also just, are you using modern algorithms for things that are consistent with what the recommended guidelines are? Because, I mean, if I see somebody trying to select a SHA-1 encryption for, you know, phase two, that's not really a secure enough approach these days.
Well, one of the things that you touch on there that is interesting to look at that sometimes isn't necessarily considered is also the efficiency of the algorithms that you use, you know, for both encryption and decryption. I mean, that makes a huge impact over the tunnels and the VPN, the traffic that you're trying to send. And, you know, taking a look at the device, what's recommended, whether you're using, you know, a SHA-256 versus a GCM-256, depending on the chip and the design of that device, you may, you know, that could be a deciding factor between algorithm A or algorithm B. Which one do you use per device? It can make a huge difference in the total throughput for that.
Well, and your client compatibility too. If I recall correctly, GCM 384 isn't supported on Apple devices. And, you know, don't quote me on that, but when I was doing my original research a while back into GCM, this would have been a few years ago, I was looking up at that time, and maybe they support it now, but at that time, the determination that I made is I couldn't use GCM 384. You know, I couldn't go higher than 256, because if the intention was that your VPN would still work with Apple devices, well, you know, you needed to utilize a compatible algorithm that works with the client software as well. You know, and this whole thing isn't just strictly about, you know, file hashing and encryption for VPN tunnels. This is also about compatibility, functionality with regards to web browsers that you're using, web browsers interacting with web assets. So people that are, you know, managing web assets, I think oftentimes are not controlling the TLS levels, for example. Is it IIS Crypto? Is that the tool? I think it's IIS Crypto. There's a sweet little tool that's for free that you can download, and it runs as a standalone little thing, and you just put it like in Ctemp on your server and you run it, and it will give you the biggest easy button I've ever seen for configuring what are the types of algorithms you're going to support, what are the TLS levels you're going to support. Like, okay, I'm going to uncheck SSL because I don't want to support that because it's an, you know, it's a deprecated thing. I think that's another big problem out there, is there's so many people managing website hosted things that don't actually run through that extra step of actually securing it on the server side.
Agreed. As an industry, and you mentioned it, the easy button, folks have gotten to rely so heavily on GUI interfaces, being able to step through items, configurations, and building things. They don't typically think beyond what is immediately presented to them. A number of years back, I did a talk regarding the technology gap of in generations, the generational technology gap. And usually when you think of that, we're thinking about, our mom, our grandpa, trying to program the VCR how to use things. But nowadays, exactly, it goes the other way. You know, when I got into technology and we were building a computer, we had to manually set a hard drive as to whether it, you know, what bus it was on, what, you know, whether it was the master, whether it was the slave. You know, we had to manually configure all of these things. If we wanted applications to work with one another on our computers, there were additional little plugins or you know, pieces that we would have to download and install and configure for those to work properly. Today, the kids that would come program the VCRs for grandpa 20 years ago, but today the kids, you know, ask them how they connect to the internet on their phone. And it's like, well, you know, I just press this application. Well, what do you do if it doesn't work? Well, I close it and I reopen it. Okay, and if that doesn't work, well, then I'll uninstall the application and reinstall it. But how does that actually work? And they can't tell you. And I ran into this working at a school. They were using iPads with Google Classroom and had all recently converted from using computers in the computer lab running Microsoft products. So, you know, we've got the big three all trying to play together, and, you know, Google Doc would not directly print a Microsoft Word document. You could open it, but you had to convert it over to the Google format before you could, and the kids couldn't figure that out, because they had no troubleshooting. They didn't have to tinker with anything to be able to make that work.
Yeah.
So, you know, it at this point, that generational technology divide is almost reversed.
Yeah. Yeah. To that point. So another interest, you know, a few fascinating points off of what you said. It'd be interesting to look at how many people are still alive that understand how to program an auto exec bat in a config sys file. You know, and yet, you know, these are real things that we may still end up encountering in manufacturing environments or, you know, industrial control spaces. And you know, how do you, you have basically no chance in heck trying to find a young person who knows how to do that stuff. You know, you were talking about the hard drive jumpers and stuff. I had a situation in the last few months here where a PC, basically the OS borked and it needed to be reinstalled. And it was, it had like an NVMe hard drive in the computer. And so the drivers to access the storage had to be slipstreamed effectively into the OS install process because the drivers were not included in the OS built-in default drivers. So Dell has this little tool that you're supposed to be able to use to download a Windows installer that has all that built in it, but it didn't work. And so I called up their tech support and they're like, oh, well, we'll send a technician with a new hard drive for you that has the image on there. And I'm like, no, I need to fix this now. And so I ended up just solving it myself because I knew how to go get the drivers and inject them into the OS installation process, which is something actually I couldn't find documented anywhere on the internet. So I was, you know, accessing it from the far back vaults of my mind from, you know, the Wayback Machine of building servers by hand in, you know, 1999, right? You know? And so what do these young kids do when they've not had those experiences? You know, on the topic of the web servers, yeah, I mean, people are installing things and they're like, woohoo, it works. And they literally are not understanding that there's still these security vulnerabilities with that. And I hope that that whole thing changes as continuous vulnerability assessment becomes something that becomes more, you know, widely adopted. And there was a conference I was at. It was a remote conference and the attendees were virtually, you know, attending, but the chat was basically open to all. And there ended up being a bit of a flame war that occurred, because there was this whole hot debate over CLI versus web UI. And you could tell some very clear delineation between all of the people that really had long-term networking skills were like CLI, because, you know, that the CLI commands, they stay consistent, you know, for decades and decades and decades. On the other hand, look at what happened when Aruba purchased the Procurve line from HP. You know, then they went through a process of like rebranding the web UI for the switches, and like the entire procedure that you would utilize in order to manage that switch through the web UI completely changed. So an organization that had built their procedures around these are the buttons that you click in this order, etc. Well, they would now have to go through a whole dev process and redo all their documentation to figure that out. On the other hand, if they had just had a CLI-based process, those commands never changed.
Well, I think personally, I was probably at least 10 years behind the curve. And I think I got out of a little bit of the server administration by the time I finally started to lightly accept configuring the Dell Perk RAID cards or RAID controllers through the GUI that they had been putting out for a decade. I was still going into, you know, the BIOS and hot keying out to get to that interface because I just never trusted the GUI enough through the OS that was running on top of that RAID already,
right,
to be able to effectively manage that.
Well, I mean, all you have to do is look at what is actually happening with these GUI modes. Like if you've done an Exchange upgrade or even an Exchange install, and this is true really if you're looking also at SQL too, there's a lot of these things that it's got this little wizard, and really when you look at the guts of what's happening in the background, all it's doing is it's running PowerShell scripts with, you know, all of this syntax injected, you know? So the only thing that the web UI or the GUI ever did for you was just simply to build the command line for you. The command line is still doing the work.
Sure. And if in that, with a lot of those GUI configurators or tools, you know, especially going back to like Exchange, is the GUI was incomplete. You would still have to look up and reference commands and use those through PowerShell or eventually the Exchange Management Console to be able to fully configure and secure Exchange.
I think sometimes it was also a visibility issue. I mean, a good example of that is the certificates. Like, the GUI didn't actually expose to you all of the details that you needed for appropriate Exchange server certificate management. On the other hand, PowerShell did. So, woe be to the young people who do it all through the GUI.
Well, you know, I found entertainment in going through NT in 2000, and eventually they made the big announcement that you know, we've done away with the command line. It's no longer built on DOS. You don't need that anymore. Only, 10, 15 years later, well, now we've got PowerShell to get back to the command line to be able to do all these things that we still needed to do through DOS, even though it wasn't built on that anymore and we didn't need it.
Yeah.
Just going full circle. So now you have all these administrators that have been at it for, you know, maybe a decade or so that are having to learn PowerShell and command line when, you know, they tried to do everything GUI.
And now there's even this converged terminal in the new versions of Windows that will actually take Linux commands. You know, so.
Because we don't need any further confusion.
Yeah, well, it just, like you said, it's full circle. The CLI stuff is coming back. Well, so we got like 2 minutes here. So do you want to wrap us up with some recommendations on what are good encryption settings to utilize for like network layer security, for branch office VPN tunnels, for example?
I like higher numbers.
Yeah.
The bigger the number, the better off we are. May not be the most efficient for you, but I like higher numbers, you know?
Yeah. But you have things like Diffie-Hellman numbers, and then you have things like perfect forward secrecy, which can be on or off, and all of those kind of cumulatively combine together.
Sure. I mean, when configuring a tunnel, when setting those things up, typically I try not to use the recommended Diffie-Hellman. I will grab, I think now the products that we use tend to default to 14. I like grabbing a different one just because it's not the default. Usually I'm looking at, I try and go at least with like SHA-256. For that AES 256, I like using the higher encryptions with the devices that we use versus like a mobile VPN or an individual VPN. We have the option of using UDP or TCP for the communication for that, and the TCP to me kind of seems a little bit redundant, because encapsulated within that encryption to the actual end device at the end of that tunnel, it's already doing TCP. So we don't need to double check that if it needs to resend something. And using a UDP can greatly increase your throughput.
Okay, well, thank you for the sage wisdom. And that's the show for today. I look forward to your comments and questions.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first Saturday of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, go to her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community.